when we feel like we matter to others, which is really what belonging is about, then that kind of communicates to us that we matter, you know, in general, which is what meaning is about.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Repurposed. I'm your host, Jared Sebesta of Taegis Financial Group. We are a retirement planning firm based in West Central Minnesota, where we teach and inspire true wealth. We believe that there are three components to having true wealth. Number one, living with purpose. Number two, having impact on other people. And number three, leaving a legacy at the heart of our company and at the heart of all of our team members. That is the type of life that we are trying to inspire. If you want more information, you can check us out online at taegisfinancial.com. Or you can give us a call at 320-222-4236. Well, thanks so much for tuning into this podcast. We call it Repurposed because the founder of our company, Ben Taegis, wrote a book by the same title, Repurposed. And this book is all about finding and redefining your purpose in life once you retire. If you want the first two chapters of Repurposed, just go to our website, taegisfinancial.com, and then click on Heard Us on the Radio for your free gift just for listening here today. Well, on this episode of Repurposed, I'm bringing you a conversation I had with a gal by the name of Emily Esfahani Smith. Now, Emily is an author. She's a speaker. She's based in Washington, D.C., and her background is in journalism. And I think that that gave her kind of the investigative mindset to explore this idea of happiness and more so what makes people happy. And this study that she went on kind of laid the foundation for her book, which she launched a few years back, called The Power of Meaning: Finding Fulfillment in a World Obsessed with Happiness. And in this podcast, Emily describes what she calls the four pillars of living a meaningful life. And she does a great job of defining the key differences between a person chasing after happiness versus someone who is really living out a life of significance and meaning. Here is my chat with Emily Esfahani Smith.
Journalist and a writer in Washington, D.C. But, you know, I think ever since I was young, and especially in high school and college years, and then afterwards getting my career start as a journalist, I've always been interested in these big questions. You know, what is happiness? How can we lead a good life? What is a meaningful life? What is the role of religion or relationships in our lives? And it led me to studying philosophy when I was in college, and then to studying positive psychology in graduate school, which is this subfield of psychology that concerns itself with these very questions, like how do we flourish? What is a good life? But they use research and empirical findings to try to answer those questions. And it was really in graduate school, and I was, you know, I continued working as a journalist during that time, where I encountered some of these ideas that I'm now writing about. And so, you know, positive psychology, there's a lot of emphasis on happiness and what can we do to make ourselves happy, to experience more positive emotions. And certainly in our culture, there's this idea that what we're all aspiring towards is a happy life. You know, we think that that's the whole point and purpose of life. But within the positive psychology research, the idea of well-being is actually much more complicated and nuanced. And what I learned is that this pursuit of happiness and valuing it the way that we're constantly encouraged to do can actually make people unhappy. And so that was kind of my first entry into this writing about happiness and meaning, was that particular finding, which really surprised me, along with the fact that even though things are getting a lot better in material terms, objectively, people are feeling worse. So what is that about? So that's kind of my background and how I got into writing about these things several about 10 years ago.
Yeah. So, and you actually went to school and did some research on this, which I want to get into, but you just mentioned, you know, as a society, we're doing better than probably we ever have in human history, but yet there's this conundrum that we have inside of us where, you know, we have everything, but yet we are so unfulfilled. Why is that? Do you just have some personal perspective on how have we gotten to this point?
Well, there's actually really interesting research on it. And this is part of what led me to writing this particular book, The Power of Meaning. So when you look at the research and when researchers try to understand what is driving the rising tide of despair from, you know, we have rising depression rates, rising rates of anxiety, rising rates of self-harm, especially among the young, rising suicide rates. All of these metrics of mental illness are sadly, tragically, have been on the rise for decades, and not just in the United States, but in developed countries all over the world. So there's something about modern society, you know, developed societies, that is cultivating a crisis of despair. And when the researchers try to understand what is driving this, what they find is that it's a lack of meaning in people's lives. That, you know, as societies become more advanced and developed and individualistic, that we start moving away from our traditional and default sources of meaning, things like community. Those bonds become looser. Religion is less in the public square, less a central part of people's lives. And so all of these changes have led people to feel a little bit adrift as they try to figure out, you know, this central question of human existence, which is how can I lead a meaningful life? What is the meaning of my life?
Yeah. Yeah, and I've almost seen some research on, and several authors have spoken up and each talked into this specific topic. But they say, you know, in America now, and I guess just civilized society, we have so many options. You know, like if you want to go out for dinner, I mean, you could go on your phone and search restaurants near me, and you get 100 options. And you know, it's kind of like counterintuitive. Like, that should actually make us happier because we have all of these options, but it's actually the opposite, you know, from what a lot of studies have shown. And I think that probably has probably played into it, just with society and the internet and technology. We're just bombarded with all of these great options, but yet we still struggle to kind of get down to the bare bones of really living a meaningful life. And again, that's what you talk about. You actually went to school and researched some of the stuff. You actually said pursuing happiness can actually make us unhappy. Talk about that.
Yeah. So, I think you're right on about this point with an overflow of choices, how that can actually make us unhappier. And certainly with meaning, like when you there are so many paths now that you can choose to follow, because these default sources of meaning are no longer guiding us along. And that can be a scary thing for people as they kind of come into adulthood, to choose which path, because there's so many and there's very little guidance. And as far as happiness, I think part of what I was responding to, which I think was especially strong at the time, this was back in, you know, 2013, when I was writing about these things for places like The Atlantic, there was so much emphasis, and I think there still is, around in the media, in the culture, about happiness being the whole point and purpose of life. All these articles about, here are three things you can do to make yourself happier.
Right.
People who are happier are more successful, have more friends, make more money. It's like this thing that we value so much. And yet, it turns out that placing that much value on happiness makes us unhappy because of a few different factors. One is that it creates the expectation that we should be happy, that happiness is attainable and is, can be a fairly stable and permanent state. And that's not true, because happiness is a, you know, a mental and emotional state of feeling good, not feeling bad. And that's, emotions come and go, it's fleeting. And
right.
I think intuitively that makes sense. There are moments when we're happy, moments when we're not happy. There's also this kind of deeper existential reality about the human condition, you know, expressed in Buddhism, for example, that life is suffering, life is chronic frustration, that just part of being a human being is that we're, you know, we're anxious and we're worried, and we can have moments of great joy, but it's not necessarily the default state of our psyches. So this expectation that we should be happy is a problem. And then the other problem is that when we're so focused on happiness, it turns out that it's a very self-directed pursuit. We're like constantly thinking about how we feel, what we should do to feel better. And it causes us to feel lonelier. So we're not focusing as much on our connections with others, which is not only important for happiness, but also for meaning.
Yeah. It seems like happiness is a very short-term, short-sighted way to view life. And what you're talking about is meaningful, where there's a deep-rooted foundation in that. Would that be a fair statement as to kind of how to define those two ways of looking at life?
Yes, definitely. I think, you know, happiness is kind of short term. It comes and goes, and meaning is this kind of deeper, more long-term pursuit. And as you're pursuing it, there'll be moments when you feel happy or unhappy because a lot of the things that we do that give our lives meaning, whether it's raising children, devoting ourselves to work that we think has value, pursuing some goal. These things are stressful, they require sacrifice, doesn't necessarily make us happy, but right. It does kind of give us this deeper sense of fulfillment over time.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is a great way to look at it. You know, me having three children and other people would probably relate to some of these things. In the near term, there's a lot of pain involved here, but there's a phenomenal amount of fulfillment that comes from that over time. And I think it goes back to kind of that short-sighted way to look at life. You've kind of coined this idea of four pillars to a meaningful life. Let's walk through some of those. What's the first one?
Right. So, you know, maybe I'll just take a second to kind of define meaning really quickly. So as I said earlier, happiness is really kind of a positive mental and emotional state, but meaning in philosophy and psychology, it's really about connecting and contributing to something bigger than yourself. And when you do that, you know, your life feels like there's more purpose, there's a value and significance to it. And, you know, when I realized that, you know, meaning is really what we should be focusing on, that's what will kind of, you know, feed our souls in a much more fulfilling way than these other pursuits, happiness, including, I wanted to know, well, what exactly do we need in our lives in order for them to feel meaningful? And so I did a lot of research, interviewed a lot of people, and in the end, noticed that there were these four different themes that came up again and again that I, you know, different people would look at the research that I had and maybe, you know, cut it a different way.
Sure.
But the way I cut it, you know, there were these four particular pillars. The first one is belonging, or, you know, being in relationships or communities where you're valued for who you are intrinsically and where you value others for who they are intrinsically. The second is purpose, which is about having some sort of goal or principle that orients your life, is valuable to you, but also involves making a contribution to others. So this can be work, raising kids, you know, these things that kind of give us something worthwhile to do with our days. The third is transcendence. And these are these kind of spiritual moments where you feel connected to something much bigger than yourself. So, you know, whether it's God or nature or the cosmos, they're awe-inspiring experiences. Traditionally, they occurred within a religious framework, meditation, prayer, you know, rituals. But today, you know, there are secular ways to experience it as well, like, you know, seeing the Grand Canyon, gazing up at the night sky, listening to music. And finally, storytelling, which is really about the story that you tell yourself, about how you became the person you are today, about how you make sense of your life and who you are.
Sure. Yeah, those are cool. Let's break each one of those down and talk about those a little bit if we could. You've talked about the first one is belonging and kind of that sense of community. You mentioned about the importance of really belonging to a bunch of people who love you and respect you for who you are. Talk about how that works and how there's maybe an unhealthy form of that sense of belonging.
Yes. So, you know, belonging is not, it's certainly true that having relationships is important for well-being, but belonging is a very specific kind of relationship where, you know, you value others for who they are as people, and they value you for who you are as a person,
right.
Which is to say that your value doesn't come from, you know, what you do, what you believe, what you achieve, who you hate, but just from who you are. So you can imagine being in a relationship or part of a group where your value does come from those other more extrinsic factors, like being in a gang or cult, where your value comes from, like, who you hate and these beliefs that you're supposed to have. And if you don't have those beliefs, or, you know, don't agree with the tenets, then you're no longer part of that group or cult. And so
right.
We hear all the time about how, you know, these groups can, like, provide belonging, but to me, this is not what real belonging is. It's a cheap form of belonging.
Right. Are you talking mainly like family, friends, or like what are other forms of belonging that maybe extend beyond, you know, your immediate family or immediate friends? What other forms do you see in this?
Definitely. I mean, certainly, you know, family, friends, those close relationships, being in communities, you know, some people find them in their, you know, churches or synagogues or whatnot. But I, you know, one of the things I learned as I wrote this book and researched it is that belonging, it's not just like a feature of our close relationships. It's something that we can cultivate, and that we can cultivate it with anyone at any moment. It's something that exists in the moment, and it's a choice that we can make, which is to say, like, you know, when you're going to get, you know, coffee or whatever, and you're interacting with the person at the cafe who's making it for you, that's an opportunity to cultivate belonging by making eye contact, by, you know, treating the other person as a human being, basically, instead of just this individual who you're conducting a transaction with. Or, you know, I don't know what it's like, you know, where you live, but in, you know, Washington, D.C., you can often, like, walk by people in your neighborhood, and, like, there's no, they, you know, you ignore each other, basically.
Yeah. No interaction.
You know, no interaction, exactly. Right. And so there are these kind of micro opportunities to cultivate belonging as well that are really important.
It's kind of a hyper spiritual curveball here, but like, why is that? Do you think we're just created to be social beings, and this is kind of just in our DNA? Why is this such a big deal?
Definitely. I think that it's, you know, we are, you know, social beings. We, you know, we, that is part of our history and our ancestry. We couldn't survive without the group. And so, you know, that's just part of, yeah, it's intrinsic to us, I think, our DNA and our genetic legacy. And also, I think, you know, because of that, we come to know ourselves in relationship to another. And there is kind of a spiritual dimension to this as well. And the great, you know, religious stories, religious myths, the human being is always conceived as whole and complete only when it's in relationship to another person, usually, you know, in like a romantic love situation. And so, you know, when we feel like we matter to others, which is really what belonging is about, then that kind of communicates to us that we matter, you know, in general, which is what meaning is about.
Cool. The second one is purpose. And you talk about, you know, really serving other people. You tie this to job and how it can be through our job, but that can also be kind of done in an unhealthy way. Talk about purpose and its respect to our employment and in our careers.
So I think most people, when they think about purpose, they think about their jobs, and they, you know, have this expectation that they should be in careers that that give them a sense of purpose, kind of with a capital P, you know, this thing that will kind of fulfill them. And this is something that's, you know, relatively speaking, it was kind of a recent development. Let me rewind and say that it's always been the case, you know, certainly, you know, in the Protestant tradition, that there, what we do is an opportunity for, you know, finding meaning and making meaning. But I think that more recently, as other sources of meaning have kind of faded away, like, you know, religion and, you know, family, people are marrying later, having children later, these kinds of things, that there's more emphasis placed on work as a source of meaning. And that can be a problem, because it could give us unrealistic expectations about what work is and what work should be. You know, if you don't find your calling, then you're not in the job that you're passionate about, then that means that your work isn't meaningful, and that therefore your life is not meaningful.
Yes.
So that's a problem. But I think, you know, there's ways to find meaning in anything that you do. Just it requires having the right mindset.
Well, I think it goes back to what you said. Really, the whole point of purpose is not about yourself. It's to serve others. You can do that through your job, but you can do that 1,000 other ways. And I think that's really interesting you bring that up. I actually totally agree with you. I think in so many ways we give our jobs a role it's not supposed to have. And I have a theory. I think that's probably why so many people are so don't like the jobs and careers they're in, because they're trying to find so much fulfillment out of this thing that was never really created to get fulfillment out of. You don't get fulfillment out of your job. You get fulfillment by serving other people and things through your job. That's a totally different way to look at your job and your career. So I have to agree with you big time on that one. That's good stuff. So the last one, or the third one, you talk about transcendence and really kind of stepping outside of yourself, whether, you know, I think probably religion can come into play here. Now, you mentioned staring up at the starry sky. Why is this so important to be able to kind of get outside of ourselves a little bit?
Yeah, so it's similarly, you know, when we talked about belonging in relationships, is there something that's part of the human psyche, the human soul, that, you know, calls out for relationships? And I think the answer is yes. It's similar with transcendence. You have, you know, sociologists, religious scholars throughout history saying that, like, human nature has two parts. You know, one is the kind of profane part that is, you know, in the everyday world, eating, sleeping, drinking, you know, doing all the stuff that keeps us busy. But then you have this other part that yearns for contact with the sacred, with you know, the transcendent, the mysterious, the awe-inspiring, and that this part is awakened when we do come in contact with you know, the things that are awe-inspiring, whether it's you know, in prayer, feeling the presence of God, or being in nature and just, you know, marveling at the beauty and the vastness of it, and recognizing how small you are in the face of that. People who have these kinds of experiences rate them as among the most meaningful ones of their lives. And it's because oftentimes when you have a transcendent experience, you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson, the American transcendentalist, talked about it. You know, I'd go for walks in the woods, and I felt like a transparent eyeball, by which he meant, like, I felt like my sense of self would dissolve, and I would become one with the world around me. So that sense of unity with the world around you is part of why those experiences are so meaningful. And the other reason is because they kind of, they shift the way we think about things. They make us realize that our normal everyday concerns are much more petty than we realized, and that there is something kind of meaningful and mysterious and unknowable that, you know, is redemptive and makes helps us make sense of this world and helps us make sense of our own kind of puniness in the face of this larger thing.
Yeah, I would totally agree with you. I love to vacation out in the mountains. That's kind of where I love to go. And I mean, especially in America with just the bombardment of emails and social media and all the news, it's like, it's just a phenomenal way to disconnect. When I personally go out west and go to the mountains, I totally agree. And I think that is just a healthy exercise to do. So I couldn't agree more. The last one you mentioned is storytelling, and really this is the story that you like to tell about yourself. But again, this can play into it. This can be negative as well, right?
Yes. So, you know, storytelling, we're meaning-making creatures. We have to be able to make sense of who we are and why things happen. And storytelling is how we do this. The narratives that we spin about the world around us, and about how we became the person that we are today. But there are different kinds of stories that you can tell. You can tell, you know, psychologists who study them have found that there are, you know, stories that are redemption stories where, you know, things can go from, you know, bad to good in your life. There are contamination stories where things go from good to bad, and that they're the people who tell certain kinds of stories about their lives do rate their lives as more meaningful. And those stories are redemption stories defined by growth, and stories defined by love. So if you see your life as like, if you tell the story of your life, you know, I was really lonely until I met my wife, and then like my life became so much more full. That's like a redemption story. So it's not just, it's like the story of your whole life, like, you know, understood as one thing, but also the story of particular things that happen in your life, that those are also ways that you can kind of make meaning.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is some great stuff. So belonging, purpose, transcendence, and storytelling. What is one thing here? We got about a minute and a half left. What is one thing that we can do as listeners here that can help us live a more meaningful life? You mentioned making just conversation with the barista at the coffee shop. Is there something tangible that I can do and we can do as listeners to really kind of tap into some of these four pillars that you mentioned?
You know, if storytelling is has interest, it seems interesting, and it often tends to be the pillar that people are most surprised by, because they don't always realize that our minds are constantly crafting these stories. I would suggest, you know, keeping a journal. You don't have to write in it every single day, but you know, a couple of times a week, where you are just reflecting on things that happen and asking yourself, are there different ways to interpret what happened? Especially if you are caught in kind of negative cycles of telling stories like, oh God, like I didn't get a response to that email. That must mean the person doesn't like me. That must mean I'm getting fired. If you're kind of in those kinds of cycles of thinking, keeping a journal where you write about it to just kind of get the anxiety out, but also asking yourself, is there a different way to read this story? Is the data of my life actually kind of confirming the story that I'm telling, or should I bring in, you know, other bits of information to kind of tell a different kind of story? So, you know, and also just, you know, asking yourself, you know, what were the key experiences of my life? You know, how did they shape me? What did I lose? What did I gain? This kind of introspection and reflection is a really good way to build on that particular pillar.
Definitely. I sure hope you enjoyed this conversation with Emily Esfahani Smith. You know, all four of her pillars, I think, not only correspond to living a meaningful life, but also the Christian life as well. We're called to have belonging. We're called to be united in family. We're called to have purpose, definitely, when it comes to being a Christian. When it comes to transcendence, you know, just gazing upon the glory of God, that should be part of our almost daily walk with the Lord. And when it comes to storytelling, you know, using our story to impact and to evangelize to other people, that's also a part of the Christian walk. So this is a great message for everybody, but especially for the believer. Well, that'll do it for this week's episode of Repurposed. A big thanks to Faith Radio for helping us sponsor this program. If you missed any or all of this episode, visit myfaithradio.com to hear or download the podcast there. I'm Jared Sebesta. We'll see you next time on Repurposed.